Welcome to Blue Peg, Pink Peg, the bi-weekly podcast where two avid gamers and their equally avid gamer wives discuss board games, relationships, and the interactions between the two. During this episode, the Blue Pegs, as usual, discuss their recent gameplays, brief game reviews, and gaming news, as well as the factors that go into creating a successful, friendly local game store. And all the Pegs review the deck builder Core Worlds and the action selection game Brussels 1893. And now, the designers of the action selection worker placement resource management game where in-game conditions are impossible to balance summer vacation. The Pink Pegs, Carrie and Christina. And the designers of the dexterity game where your turn seems to come all too often. Cutting the grass. The Blue Pegs, Patrick and Rob. Hey, everybody, welcome to Blue Peg, Pink Peg. I'm your host, Patrick.
And I'm your host, Rob.
And we are here at episode 24.
24. Pegheads, the Greek alphabet is the script that has been used to write the Greek language since the 8th century BC. It also contains exactly 24 letters. Apart from its use in writing the Greek language both in the ancient and modern forms, the Greek alphabet today also serves as a source of technical symbols and labels in many dominions of mathematics, science, and other fields. The Greeks adopted the alphabet from an earlier Phoenician alphabet. The most notable change made was the introduction of vowels. According to this definition used by some modern authors, this feature makes the Greek alphabet the first alphabet. In the narrow sense, as it distinguished from prior alphabets using purely consonants, which according to this terminology are called abjads.
So wait, the word to describe a language that has no vowels in it has like seven vowels in it?
Yeah, abjads. But what the pegheads really want to know, Patrick, is what's on Rob's mind?
Okay.
Well, I just kind of wanted to discuss a little bit after the Jamie Stagmeyer interview, which if you haven't listened to, immediately go download. He is so knowledgeable in his field.
It's impressive.
But he inspired me because he is doing what he wants to do, Patrick.
Yeah, he wakes up in the morning. And I mean, he has a day job, but he wakes up in the morning and he makes games or he publishes games or he writes books or he gets components together.
It's great. Wake up in the morning and wonder, should I drink vodka or bourbon? No, but
bourbon.
I don't enjoy my job, and I just think it would be great.
What do you do, by the way?
It doesn't matter what I do. but I just thought it would be great to, you know, wake up in the morning and go to a job that you want to go, that you're excited to, and you open up the store, you know, whatever. And it frustrates me because I really do want to open up a game store in this area, but this area has not sustained a game store ever. As soon as one opens up, it falls apart.
Yeah, we've seen a lot come and go, and none of them were great. None of them had the F of the FLGS, in my opinion. They were local game stores, but that was about it.
Well, I knew some of the owners of them, and they were friendly. Like, they were friendly when they were there, but then they hired people to come in, and they were
not
friendly.
Who did not care. You're right. And I think that was a big part of it. But I think also, you know, there is some demographics or elements or something that are necessary for the creation and the sustainability of a friendly local game store.
Like what?
Well, I think population has got to be one of them.
Well, I think a specific population matters. Like, you don't necessarily want to open up a game store in a retirement home.
Well, you know what?
No, I'm thinking about that.
That sounds like a fabulous idea. Yeah.
What about a retirement home that was board game themed?
Yeah,
well, we should open that.
Yeah, we should open it. We would call it player elimination. We'd call it
1 foot in the grave, 1 hand on the die.
Yeah, analysis.
We should open up a thread in BGG and see if people could have a name our retirement home board game.
Yeah, please.
But in all joking aside, that's not necessarily that bad of an idea.
No, it's not. But I mean, I think leaving all that aside, you know, the fact is that you've got to have a group of people that are going to be able to come in. You know, Carrie has talked about this idea of taking two trends, two great tastes that taste great together.
Are you going to talk about the food truck?
Yes. She wants to start a food truck that we would have a canopy and we would have tables, like IKEA tables out front that we would bring out. And you can get your food, you know, your whatever, your pork fried chips or whatever they do in food trucks. I don't know what
they
do.
Oh, my God. Okay. You're not going to be doing the menu,
some
right?
Some sort of trendy food.
When you get your pork rinds.
Yeah, yeah. And then you would sit down and you'd play. You could play games. You know, we'd have a library of games that you could play. I think, you know, it's not a bad idea.
I see all kinds of problems with that idea.
Rob, that's your job. That's why I keep you around.
Well, I know that's my job. But first of all, where are you going to put all these games, right? And, you know, you're cooking food inside there, so now all your games are going to smell like pork rinds.
No. You have a trailer that you have
behind. Well, now you're carrying a trailer around?
Behind your food truck.
That doesn't seem like you're making good use of your resources.
I don't know. It does seem, I think there's something to it. You just
got to
play.
Wait, and then you have wobbly tables? Like, what are you going to play on wobbly tables?
No, they're good tables.
Nah, I don't like it. I like a food truck idea. I still like games with it.
Oh, well. I still think it's a great idea. But anyways, enough of that. One of the things I've actually been thinking about recently, you know, we've been getting some game plays together with our groups. And one of the things that bugs me with group play is when you get everybody together and you spend the first 20 minutes of your night.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of time. So when I'm able to get guys
picking out
over,
games,
you know,
yeah.
And break out the library. First of all, I like to show the library, like, and then it's like, I want to play this. I don't want to play that. I don't know how to play that, and I don't want to learn how to play a game. Grandma, go home.
Go to your retirement home.
God, they've got tic-tac-toe. But no, what I'm saying is you know, that is frustrating for me, too.
Yeah. Yeah, just that time. So what one of the gang groups has actually done is they have taken...
You're talking about Rage?
The group that we go to every so often. Roanoke Area Gaming Enthusiast. And what they've done is one of the guys, a really graphic art designer. We've discussed him before. And he made these cards up for all of his games. Then he sleeved them. And then you just take... And all the group's games. And you pull them out and you pick out three. And then you vote between which of those three games you're going to play. So that you always are playing something new.
That's an incredibly cool idea.
Yeah, it does work well.
Now, what happens if the votes are tied?
Well, you know...
Deathmatch.
Yeah, deathmatch. Exactly. We slather ourselves down with pork fat, of course.
Why do you have pork fat on the brain?
I have a lot of pork fat. I went to Costco, and I made an unwise purchase. I'm trying to come up with some tactics.
Is that why I couldn't put my beer in your fridge? That was all pork fat?
Pork fat, yeah.
Oh, thank God. I thought you had like a Hannibal situation in there. One of the things that we've also initiated when I don't go to Rage is that when we have a game night, to bypass the sitting around for 25 minutes picking games, is that if you have a game you want to play, what you say is, look, I am playing X game. If you guys want to play it, the first five people who say they want to come play, we're having a game night at my house where I'm playing that game.
Yeah, I like that. I like that method a lot. It's a really good way to kind of, you know, first know what you're in for.
Right.
You know, like what kind of night you're going to be dealing with. If you don't know the game, then you can go online and kind of read the rules a little bit so you can be prepared. And, you know, and it kind of encourages me sometimes to get out on a night when I otherwise wouldn't, because I'm like, you know what, I really want to get that game. So I'll come over and do that. And I do think it's a good tactic. It's worked out really well as far as getting more games to table and getting going quicker.
Well, this is actually perfect. This transitions to what I've been playing.
Oh, really? What have you been playing?
A buddy of our, Jeremy, owns CO2. Now, we've talked about playing CO2 during RobCon, but it ended kind of badly because everybody got mad and walked away from
it. Yeah.
But I could tell that it was a good game.
Yeah, I wish I could have come and played it with you guys.
So he said, everybody come over, we'll play it. We played it with four people. I like this game. I don't understand why it hasn't gotten more buzz. I think I'm going to borrow it from Jeremy and we review it at one point.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a good game. If you're, you know, curious about it, you can check it out on BGG or whatever. It's crafted, it's balanced, it's fun to play. The only issue, and even on the second play, I agree, it's just super fiddly. Like,
yeah.
You know, you want to buy, you want to purchase or install or whatever the terminology is, a plant somewhere in North America or Europe or wherever the situation is. You have to know there's all kinds of little things you have to look at, you know, and then
to know if you can do that.
Yeah, yeah, and then like once you build something, you have to, you know, you get some sort of expertise in something like solar energy or recycling or whatever. It's just really fiddly. You're moving. This would be a great iOS game. I know it never will be. It's just not the type of game, but it is a good game. So I expect a review of CO2 in the future.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to playing that. Well, talking of fiddly games, I've got one that's not as deep as CO2, and not as fiddly, but somewhat fiddly nonetheless. Carrie and I have played a game called Infinite City.
Is that the tile? Is it tile laying?
Yeah, it's a tile laying game. It's by AEG, publishes it. And the way it works is it comes with a boatload of tiles. The stack is a good foot and a half high if you stack them up.
So far, you're saying things that Christina would like.
Yeah, I think she would like this. Everybody has 15 markers, and what you do is you have a tile that's in the center, and then you've got four tiles on each of its sides. And every tile has to be laid adjacent to another tile. You can't be diagonal, they have to be adjacent. And you lay a tile down, and you put your marker on top of it. And every tile is a different type of building within the community, and in this futuristic community. And what it does is when you lay that tile down, it triggers an effect. One of them may be turn over an unturned tile, or one of them may be swap the marker of your tile with an opponent's tile, or move a tile, or lay an extra tile. Every time you lay a tile and put your marker on it, you're going to be able to do different stuff. And there are some tiles that can have multiple markers on them. There's special tiles that if at the end of the game, you will you'll set this all out. Once somebody lays out 15 of their cubes, their little markers, mm-hmm. the game ends. And what happens
is, are some of the tiles pull up your markers?
Yeah, some okay. of them. I mean, there's lots of just, it's a lot of action going on through the game.
Okay.
Everything triggers some effect, and there will be combos that will get triggered, that sort of thing.
How do you win the game? Is it points?
Well, yeah, points. Here's the interesting thing about it. The way the points work is you get to score a point for every one of your adjacent markers. So if I had four markers in an L, okay, mm-hmm. that would be 4 points.
Okay.
Or if I had six in an L, or if I had six in an L and then over to the side, dog leg. You know, just as long as I've got a stream of my markers contiguous, I can count those. And additionally, you look at these special tiles that give you points, and then there's also these special tiles that you look at who has the most on those, and that player gets the value of those tiles. So the one with majorities
and
gets that value.
You compute all the points at the end of the game.
At the
right?
end of the game, yeah.
So what's fiddly about this?
Well, the fiddly thing about it is multifold. You're going to be moving tiles around, and you got to pay attention to where people are and what they're doing. And then the other thing is it plays up to, I think, six. But even with just two, it takes up a million miles of real estate. It covers our – if you played with a six-player game, we have a pretty big table that we play games on. It would cover that table up. It's insane, and you've got to pay attention to, you know, where people are – and you know, who's got majorities on this and who's got majorities on that.
You got to bring this over. This sounds interesting to me. It doesn't sound fiddly. It just sounds like it takes up a lot of space.
Yeah, well, it does take. I guess maybe I'm misusing the term. It does take up a lot of space. We've played it several times and enjoyed it a lot. Carrie's won a couple of times. I think we're balanced as far as each of us winning it a couple of times each in the gameplays that we've given to it. And one that I'm looking forward to playing some more, but I agree. I think it's one that Christina will like a lot because it's a great tile laying game.
And that was called?
That's called Infinite City.
What else have you been playing?
Well, I've also been playing Shinobi Wata. I previewed this last time in the last episode that we had. And I want to talk a little bit about it. I've gotten it, and I've been playing it, and I've been playing it a ton.
Now, it's just a two-player card game, right?
No. It plays four. It plays two, two, four. And I played with two, three, and four. I've probably played it 10 times, maybe 15, since I've gotten it. And there are two modes that you can play it in. You can play it in Grasshopper mode, which is a basic quick game, or you can play it in the Masters mode, which is essentially three games that combine together to create a larger game.
Mm-hmm.
And I've played both versions. But the way that that Grasshopper works is, you know, you've got these cards that are in different clans. So there's like, I think there's like 14 or 15 clans. I don't know. There's lots of clans. And you lay them out, and you can put only four in a clan. And if you lay out two, then you get to trigger the basic power. If you lay out three or more at a time, then you can trigger the advanced power. And it's things like trade cards with someone else or eliminate someone's clan. And what happens is as soon as somebody lays out four clans, regardless, they don't have to be full, then the game ends immediately. And everybody totals up their points because each of the cards has different values on it. Now, some clans have cards that are of lower value. Some clans have cards that are of higher value. There are also these special cards that you can lay as reinforcements in order to have special powers. You know, one of them, just lay a card to reinforce. It may be low point value, but it lets you draw five new cards. You can also, instead of drawing a card at the beginning of the turn, you can say, I'm going corrupt. you're going to draw a card off the top of the deck. The value of that card plus two is how many cards you draw. Okay, so you put that card in your corruption pile. You'll be negating those points from your score at the end of the game. So if you get a two, you're going to lose 2 points, but you're going to get 4 cards. Having a big, robust hand is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then in the Masters version, you play a bunch of rounds of that, and then you have these special powers that you can use, and you're trying to defeat this monster by putting these shuriken tokens on it in order to defeat it or to get points in the game.
Have you been playing this with?
I've been playing it with Carrie and Garrett, but mostly Garrett.
Garrett being your boy.
Garrett being my son. And if you looked at the box top, it would go Garrett, 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 Patrick, Garrett, Garrett.
Now, is this
Garrett,
in Grasshopper Garrett. Mode or Master mode?
Both. Mostly Grasshopper because he just likes to play multiple games of it over and over again. But the kid is a master of like looking at my cards and being like, yep, all right, I'm ending it now. I mean, he closes That's the door cool. on me all the time,
so
and
jealous.
It's pretty incredible. So that is Shinobi Wata. This is by Yellow, and it is a high recommend for me.
To end the evening on the CO2 night, we played a game called Boss Monster. Now, I think this was a Kickstarter card game. It's a quick, light game. How you play, everybody gets a boss monster. And what you're doing is you're setting up a dungeon that adventurers are going to go through, and you're trying to kill adventurers. So you start off, and you get X amount of dungeon cards, and you get X amount of these spell cards that use to affect your dungeon or other people's dungeons or anything like that. And most of the dungeon cards have some ability that either you can kill part of your dungeon to kill an adventurer going through it or whatever. All the dungeon cards have some sort of ability. They also, most of the dungeons attract a certain type of adventurer, whether it be a warrior, a mage, a cleric, etc. Now, these adventurers are trying, as I said, try to get through your dungeon. If you kill them as they get through your dungeon, you put them in a pile that says that you've killed. If they get through your dungeon, you put them next to your dungeon. And if X amount of adventurers get through your dungeon, you're out of the game. You're eliminated.
So player elimination.
Yeah, so the first person who kills X amount of adventurers wins the game. If they get through your dungeon, you lose. You also get a boss monster. Everybody gets an individual boss monster that does something. And each dungeon card, I forgot to mention this, also does damage to those adventurers as they go through. Now, it was an interesting game. It is an elimination game. And I was eliminated pretty early. Now, I had a couple beverages. Okay, and maybe I didn't really understand the rules when I first started, so maybe a healthy mixture of those two things affected it, but I got eliminated in the third round.
Okay.
And
is that very early?
It was early. I feel like it was early.
Okay.
Because I didn't know what I was doing. I'm setting out cards. I happen to collect. There's a lot of luck in this game. So one of the dungeon cards I put out attracted a lot of clerics. Now, at every turn...
Clerics!
I always play clerics, by the way, when I role play. Just a little FYI. Anyway, at the start of every turn, X amount of adventurers come out, and they go to whatever dungeon that mostly attracts to them. If two different dungeons attract, like you get 2 points of, like if one dungeon attracts two thieves worth of whatever, I can't remember what the terminology is, and the other dungeon also has two for the attraction of a thief, the thieves don't move. But anyway, I had played a card that attracted 2 clerics worth of whatever. So all the clerics, when the adventurers flipped up, there was like 5 clerics, and all the clerics came through. My dungeon was small. I got destroyed, and then I sat there and watched them play for like 20 minutes while I just sat there and watched them play.
Yeah, so I guess the takeaway from that is that it's an interesting game, but it's not balanced, and luck can have a big impact upon early gameplay. Like you can get eliminated.
And again, I think that if I understood the rules a little more, maybe if I didn't have a couple beverages, I would have played a little better. But again, there is that thing that you can get eliminated super early. But luckily, it's a light game.
Yeah.
So it'll go by really fast.
I have a light card game that I have played a little bit, and that is I Say Holmes.
Now before you go into that game, I love the artist that does the artwork for that. They also did the Treste.
Yeah, did the artwork for Treste and some other games from Victory Point Games. This is a Victory Point Games Kickstarter that's going on right now. Now, at the time that you hear this, there's going to be about 3 days left in this Kickstarter. So if this is something that interests you, you should probably head over and check it out ASAP. You can get it for $35. Now, that's a new version. They're apparently going to be using some of that money to get a new printer that's going to allow them to print some premium type cards. So they're going to have really nice cards in them, a little different than the ones that I played with. If you pay $60, you can get a copy of that with Treste, as a matter of fact. It plays for 3 to 8. It's about 30 minutes per round is the play of the game. And the components are great. The art is really quite wonderful.
I would love to have a portrait done by that guy.
He's a very, very talented
artist.
Maybe
have me a little thinner in a three-piece suit with a top hat.
Well, yeah, because he does
I would immediately put that portrait right in the middle of my living room.
His Edwardian work is really quite wonderful. The pictures are really nice. He does some really good villains. He draws all the classic villains. Now, one of the great advantages of this game, now it is a victory point game, so you're going to have that black soot on your hands, and they are on the cardboard that can be a little difficult to punch out. But I will say the bits are nice. You know,
what's the gameplay like?
The way it plays is everybody gets a hand of cards, and you take those cards, and one player, you have a constructed deck for the first bit that it's going. So you'll have everybody will have certain specific cards in their hands. And then the draw deck is shuffled up, and you're going to have that in the middle. And whoever has the I Say Holmes card will lay that down first. And that is going to say at the bottom of it that there's a certain class of cards that must be played upon it. And then if you have any cards within that class, these are in particular on that one, it's a travel card. You have to put a mode of travel down. It's a hansom cab or a train. Now, if you lay down the train, then the next thing is going to have to be a location that is going to be different than the location that you're in. If you're in the city, it's the city sides up, you're going to have to lay a country card. If you're in the country, you're going to have to lay a city card.
Okay.
Okay. Now, but if it's a hansom cab, then it has to be the same location.
By the way, I think we need more hansom cabs in the world.
I agree. There's also a fog card that allows you to lay any location down. And the neat thing about the fog card is everybody takes one card out of their hand, you shuffle them all up, and then you deal them out to everybody. So everybody's randomly going to get somebody else's card.
Okay.
Then they're going to lay down something, and it's going to lay down maybe there are 5 different classes of cards that you could lay, like suspicion cards or constabulary cards or clue cards. And you're going to take a card that fits in that class, and you're going to, any of those classes you can choose, and then you're going to lay that down. So it's basically you're chaining. Okay. Now, when you lay down certain cards, you're going to be able to look at other people's cards. It'll say, look at 2 cards randomly selected, or look at 2 cards selected by them, or look at their entire hand. Now, you're also going to have these I Say Holmes cards.
Yeah, what are you trying to do?
Well, yeah, I'm going to get to that. The I Say Holmes cards are the cards that you are the aides of Holmes, and they're superpowered. If you play those in sequence, then you get a clue token that's going to give you points at the end of the game. Now, some players, one player or many players, will have one or many villain cards. Now, they are trying to get everything out of their hand except for their villain cards and any interruption cards that they have, alibis, that sort of thing. And there are always defensive cards you can use. If somebody wants to look at your cards, you can lay an alibi and keep them from looking at them. They're trying to get rid of all their cards except for their villains. If they do that, that villain escapes, and they claim that villain from the pile, and they'll get the victory points for that villain. Now, if someone looks at someone's card who has a villain card in it, there's an arrest made. The round ends, and the player that made the arrest, they total up the value of every card, and there's some bonus cards out there, and you find the one that's closest to that without going over. You pull that, and they get points for that. So you're going to play multiple rounds of that, and you're trying to tally up points. There are a lot of other things you can do. You can send telegraphs to people, which give them negative points. You can do various things to build up their hands, make their hands bigger, make their hands smaller, that sort of thing. It is a fine game. It plays well with multiple players. It isn't the most tactically rich game. There is a lot of luck involved in it because the cards that you have are going to play a lot what you can do, and you're very often not going to have a lot of options as far as what you can lay down. That said, there are ways that you can, you know, if you identify early who you think the villain cards are, you can load their hands up to kind of keep them from being able to run out before you can arrest them. It's a good game. It's, you know, again, there's a lot of luck to it, but it's quick, and it plays easily. It's really easy to teach. So that is I Say Holmes, one that, you know, if you're into a nice little light party game, something you want to get out, I recommend it. If you are a fan of Sherlock Holmes, I highly recommend it because
Definitely. It
does a really nice job of bringing in all the major players within the canon. And so you're going to get a kick out of seeing some more obscure villains, some more obscure aides and assistants to Holmes. So that is I Say Holmes.
Now, in the past 2 weeks, there's been a lot of news that has gotten me super excited.
Yes.
But nothing more than another failed game called Aquasphere.
Yes.
I'm just going to read straight out from the press release.
That sounds great, because it's pretty exciting.
Aquasphere is a research facility stationed deep below the ocean's surface, and your skilled team consisting of an engineer, a scientist, reprogrammable bots, and exploratory submarines, is trying to gather as much data as possible. The game board in Aquasphere has two main areas, a research station comprised of six sectors in which your scientist conducts experiments, and headquarters where your engineer supervises preparation of your bots. So it looks like the game takes place in four rounds. But during those rounds, you take several turns. You use your engineers in the headquarters to program a bot. Each round, you can choose from 3 to 7 actions. So it sounds like a felt game,
yeah,
where you have a lot of stuff you can choose from. Or you can also have your scientists bring a bot to a sector to perform an action. So through your actions, you're improving your lab, you're sending out submarines, you're collecting crystals, you're examining octopuses or octopi.
It's actually octopod.
Is it octopod?
Yep. Because the root is Greek. If it were Latin, it'd be octopi, but because it's Greek, it's octopod.
Well, in the press release, it says octopuses. and you can expand your abilities of your teams to gather knowledge points, all necessary to win. And I saw a prototype of the game.
I saw that too.
It looks like it's right up my alley.
It does look
so
really
I
wonderful.
Am calling dibs on buying this game.
Yeah, well, you can buy it. That is great. I you're my friend, so I'm going to let you do it. I might buy it myself. But it does look pretty incredible, and one that we are looking forward to. You know, it's interesting. He has got La Isla coming out this year as well, and that's another one that's research-based. You're on an island, and you're researching various type of species of animals on that.
But it looked light to me.
La Isla looks very light. Yeah, it's actually in the Alea light line. Who's going to be publishing it. This looks like a heavy game. It looks really wonderful.
Almost kind of like a Bora Bora to me, but
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it very much. Another game that has been coming out, or rather an expansion, we are big fans of Cosmic Encounter.
Yes, we are.
And they've got a lot of expansions for the game, and the expansions for Cosmic Encounter are, generally speaking, they add neat elements. Some are better than others, but they all add something unique to the
Insanity.
Game. Yes. This one is Cosmic Dominion. And what is unique about this one is every alien species has been designed by fans of the game.
How super cool is that?
I know, it's really awesome.
Has it been play tested?
It has. They selected them apparently. I read a little on the press release. They've selected them and then they've refined them. So they've taken them and they first went through and found which ones were going to work best. They play tested them to see which ones were going to work as far as balanced, and then I guess they tweaked them a little bit so that they would be more fully balanced. The thing that's such a thrill, could you imagine designing an alien species and having the exquisite Fantasy Flight art of
that is
card,
so cool.
You know, there. The one that we put up on our Twitter feed was The Bride. And The Bride is a power, because of course we're Blue Peg, Pink Peg, but The Bride is a power you can marry any other player where you guys work together. And then throughout the game, in order to do various things, you can contribute and stuff.
That would make me insane.
There's also, you can within the bride setting, you can also divorce. And there's alimony that has to be paid. If you have to pay, like, they have
that's
to pay
so much
alimony.
Fun.
It's just a neat little element.
Did it mention when it's coming out?
It's coming out soon. I think it's coming out quarter 3. I think this is a
Gen
release.
Con?
Maybe. I suspect they like to have expansions ready for Gen Con.
Well,
so
that's going
to
be an instant buy for me.
Yeah, I think that it will be a really good one. Now, another thing that we've been talking about on our Twitter feed, and if you don't follow us on Twitter, you really should, because we give you some pretty good updates, and that is the newest expansion for Terra Mystica.
Another instant buy. Oh, my God. Christina's going to kill me.
I know. It's got several new, I think 6 or 7. It's got Yetis, Ice Maidens, River
races?
Walkers.
New races?
Yeah, new races. Yetis, Ice Maidens, River Walkers, Shapeshifters, Acolytes, and Dragon Masters. It's got 2 new topographies.
That's giving me chills. I just got chills.
And molten lava are going to be the new, you know, land masses that are there. The powers look pretty neat. You know, there. If you want to go, we'll link to some stuff. There's some detailed. There's a website. It's a German website that has pictures of all of the powers, and you can sort through with your Google Translate what the powers look like. But you're also going to get to see the cards. You know,
yeah,
the power cards.
Art's cool.
So it looks really, really neat.
Are there going to be any more? I don't know what the cards are called, but it's the choices that you make each turn where you can pick at the, when you say I'm done, you get to pick.
Yeah, the special power cards.
Are there any
I
more
haven't
of those?
Heard that.
Oh, God, that's what I
would
I need
like
more
to see
of.
That. Yeah. I would like to see that. But I think the new powers will be fun to play. Mm-hmm. The one thing about that game is that does make it unique is that asymmetrical play, and it is a lot of fun to. You know, I'm very much about trying a race that I haven't figured out yet every time I play that, or that even I haven't played. I don't think I've played the Fakirs yet, and I'm looking forward to playing
it. I love this game, but I am yet to be on my box top. My own box top I can't get on.
Yeah. Well, that is coming up. You better get on it quick so that before we get the new races and you'll lose with those as well. And then finally, in a little related, though not necessarily gaming news, there is a movie that has been kickstarted called Dark Dungeons. Now, Dark Dungeons is a track by Jack Chick, and these were propaganda tracks that were... I used to always see them at my barber shop. There was a metal rack, and there'd be a whole bunch of them. And they'd be things like, you know, you go see an R-rated movie, and suddenly you're walking the streets. They were very extreme.
Everything, that is a slippery slope.
Everything went from bad to worse in 0 seconds. And leaving aside, you know, I'm not commentating upon, you know, the religious... because they were religious. They were Christian. But I'm not commentating upon those. But one of the things that they, you know, this was sort of the fringe of that sort of view, and one of them was about D&D. Mm-hmm. And there was a period of time in the 80s, if you were growing up in the 80s, you know that D&D and Satanism, there was a furor around them. 2020 did these outrageously overblown sort of things about, you know, how Satanism was infiltrating all our kids, and it wasn't. Not that I would know. As I said, I grew up in a pretty conservative religious household, so I wouldn't have much access to that sort of thing.
Right.
Pretty sure wasn't going on.
Right.
No one was trying to recruit me into any covens. And I played a whole lot of D&D.
Did that bother you? I mean, maybe you just weren't worthy.
Yeah. I played a lot of D&D. And honestly, I grew up in as fundamental a Christian household as they are. And my parents were totally fine with it. But there was certainly a fringe within the community that was incensed about it. And this was a personification of that. The idea being, there's this girl, Blackleaf. She has a thief that dies in the context of the game. First of all of the dungeon masters were 50-year-old women, which I don't get. I never... Women won. Didn't see many of those in my gaming groups. They were there. Didn't see them a lot in my gaming groups, but certainly no 50-year-old women's were doing it. And so it's just this odd sort of misconception of what D&D
was. No, Blackleaf was a young girl.
She was a young girl. She was a college co-ed because that was what was going on in the colleges. You know, D&D,
right.
All the cool kids were playing D&D.
What I thought was hilarious about this a comic,
hey,
whatever.
Spoiler alert.
I'm sorry. Spoilers if you're going to read this. When Cindy, or whatever her name is, comes to talk to whoever Blackleaf, whatever her real name was, she comes in the room and she goes, "Oh no, you didn't have to do it." And Blackleaf, you see her feet dangling from the ceiling, but the chair hasn't even hit the floor yet.
Yeah.
And her feet are still moving. Shut up, Cindy. Go save your friend.
I know.
Quit talking.
I know. That's the funniest thing on that. And it just, you know, it's just all that. The D&D is, of course, a front for covens. They're learning real magic within D&D. But anyways, they have taken this track and they've adapted it to a very straight face. Like, I think it's satirizing the tract. And just
you think
that,
it is, or is it serious?
No, it is.
Okay.
If you looked at their backer page, you would know that it was very much...
Tom Hanks in a movie in the 80s about D&D?
Well, he was in Legend. Yeah,
was that the name of that one?
It was a fantasy-themed game, and it was Tim Curry was in that as well, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yeah, he was. It was dark. It was the darkest movie that I've ever seen in my life. I literally couldn't make out 80% of what was in that film.
oh, it was just filmed dark.
Yeah. It was no. Yeah, I'm talking like the cinematographer was stoned.
I think that was one of Tom Hanks' first movies.
It was one of his first movies. But in any event, leaving all that aside,
right.
this Dark Dungeons is now being made. You got to check out the trailer. One of the things that I love about the trailer, there's this frat event, and they're all chanting D&D, D&D, because they're going to be playing tournament D&D Fight Club style.
All right, I've got to say that I went to a lot of college parties. back in my day, that never happened.
What?
That never happened. And if it did happen, you can bet your butt that I would have been the one there.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, I never saw that.
Yeah, I didn't. Awesome. I didn't see that in my in my days. I didn't see the frat guys trading their 20-sided die. In my college experience, but maybe I just didn't go to the right college.
You weren't living life.
No, I wasn't. And again, they probably didn't want me. So anyways, that is Dark Dungeons, something worth checking out. Just for a lark, you should check it out, and I'm sure it's going to be a cult classic when it comes out.
So that is quite enough from us right now, so why don't we move over to the rules breakdown of the first game we're going to review in our two-game episode, Core Worlds.
Core Worlds is a deck-building game designed by Andrew Parks and published by Stronghold Games in 2011. In Core Worlds, each player takes on the role of barbarian leaders traveling from the undeveloped star empires of the decaying galactic realm to the ever more developed planets that ring the Core Worlds from which the realm is ruled, ever adding units to their growing rebellion, all in support of reclaiming the many planets that make up the seats of power. For those interested in the Pink Peg carry description, short, tight, and a little bit dirty, Core Worlds is a 2-5 player game that averages about 90 minutes per play, played by building upon an initial deck of cards over many rounds. During each round, more powerful and expensive cards are placed for bid, and players use actions and energy to purchase those cards, which they later use to conquer planets, all in support of building up a hand and resources sufficient to claim high-scoring planet cards during the game's final two rounds. The player with the most points at the end of the game, surprise, surprise, wins. So that is the core of Core Worlds. But if you want a more detailed game summary, stick around. Otherwise, you can skip to the 42-minute mark of the podcast, where I'll be joined by the rest of the Pegs to discuss our thoughts about the game. Thanks for sticking around. Now, to be honest, a detailed description of Core Worlds is not that different from the concise summary. At the start of the game, each player is given a small deck of initial cards along with a home planet card, along with draw and discard decks, and two tableaus. The first is their planet tableau, where all of their conquered planets will be displayed. The second is their war zone, where units preparing for invasion are displayed. Each player's hands of cards is essentially the same, consisting of a fairly weak assortment of each of the game's principal card types, namely units and tactic cards. However, each player will have one hero card that is unique to that player's deck. Unit cards show the card's draft cost, deployment cost, ground attack power, air attack power, along with any special abilities affiliated with that unit. Likewise, tactic cards show their draft cost, deployment cost, and impact. Now, before play begins, each player draws a home world. The player with the lowest valued home world will start play, with play proceeding clockwise around the table. Notably, since the game plays out over 10 rounds, with the first player marker passing to each player during each round, depending upon player numbers, players will go fewer times than other players, and they'll be given bonus energy tiles, the game's primary currency, when play commences. Now, they can turn in obtained bonus energy tiles at any time in the game to obtain two extra energy that can be played at that time. Now, aside from their number, the worlds are all the same, each producing three energy and allowing the player to obtain additional energy by discarding two cards from their hand. Now, this brings us to the game's phases. The first is a draw phase, where players refill their hand to six cards from the available draw pool. The next phase is the energy phase. Each player will conquer worlds as gameplay goes on. These worlds will produce energy during each energy phase. Finally, certain tactic cards may be played at this time in order to create even more energy. Now, as noted above, energy is the currency that players will spend during the action phase in order to perform actions or mount attacks on available planets. Now, the next phase is the galactic phase. During this phase, cards are drawn from the relevant draw deck in order to construct the pool of cards that can be drafted, as well as the planets that are available for conquest. The game starts with five decks that signify the units available for recruiting within each of the realms leading up to the core worlds, as well as the planets that can be invaded. These are the barbarian worlds, the frontier worlds, the industrial worlds, the luxury worlds, and of course, the core worlds. The draft conquest pool will be drawn from each deck for two rounds, before the draw moves to the next deck. Of course, the power and cost of the available units, as well as the defense strength of conquered worlds, increases from deck to deck. Any cards that remain from the prior round will be given a bonus energy unit that will be gained by the person that drafts that. While cards in the draft or conquest pool that already have energy upon them, or put another way, that have gone two rounds without being drafted or conquered, are discarded. The number of units, tactics, and worlds that are laid out will differ depending upon the number of players. Now, after the draft conquest pool is established, players can take actions, which include drafting, deploying, and invasion. Now, as I mentioned above, energy is the primary currency used within the game. In addition to energy amassed during the energy phase, each round, every player will be given the same number of actions, with actions increasing in some of the later rounds. Now, to draft a unit, a player will pay an action and the relevant energy cost and place that unit in their discard pool. To deploy a unit or units, a player will exhaust actions equal to the number of units deployed and the sum of the unit's deployment cost in the form of energy. Finally, the players can pay one energy and one action to invade an available planet by discarding previously deployed units whose fleet and ground force sums equal the planet's fleet and ground force defense powers. Of course, special powers and tactic cards can be triggered often through the payment of energy to strengthen drafting, deployment, or invasion capacity. Now, there are also certain special abilities or cards that can be played as an action. Now, each player gets to take one action of their choosing before play passes to the next player. Now, when a planet is conquered, it goes into the conquering player's planet tableau. Planets will produce energy, points at the end of the game, special powers, or a combination of the three. Players may also thin weaker cards out of their deck at the time of invasion by garrisoning one unit on that planet, or, put another way, placing it beneath the planet where it will remain for the rest of the game. Now, after all players have passed, all players' energy and actions are depleted to zero, and every player must discard all but one or all of their cards into their discard pile. Now, of course, like all deck builders, once a player's draw pile is depleted, they'll shuffle and recycle their discarded cards. During the end phase, cards with energy on them, as I said earlier, are removed from the draw pile, and remaining cards will receive energy tokens, and the first player token passes to the player to the first player's left. Now, during the final two rounds, the core worlds are attacked. Now, there are no units or attack tactics in the final deck. However, the players can obtain prestige cards, which will give them in-game victory points. Now, the planets have substantial face values and victory point values. However, they also award in-game point bonuses for certain card types within a player's units. For example, if they have Star Cruisers, they may get extra points. Or if they have Heroes, they may get extra points. Or if they have a certain number of tactic cards, they'll get extra points. Now, because the defenses of these planets are substantial, all of the players have the option of refreshing their draw deck before the ninth round. Their hand size is also increased from 6 to 7. Now, after the 10th round, points of units, heroes, planets, etc. are totaled, and bonus points are awarded, with the highest scoring player being named the leader of the New Republic and the winner of the game. So that is Core Worlds, a deck-building game with a lot of complexity that really plays upon the deck-building premise in a unique way. But before I talk too much about what I think about this game, let's head back to the table and hear what the rest of the pegs think of Core Worlds. All right, everybody, so that is the rules breakdown for Core Worlds. Let's introduce you guys to the Pink Pegs, Christina.
Hey.
Hey, and honey, Carrie Kelly.
Hi there.
Hey, sweetheart.
Wait, are we on a last name basis now?
Oh, man.
We are.
We're
formal
as Carrie Kelly.
Let's break down... Yeah, let's do that. Let's do more of that.
Yeah.
What just happened?
Was that good?
I think she just had a seizure.
Waking us up.
Did my wife just drop down some fat beats?
I don't know. Electric boogaloo.
I think I just spit into the microphone, actually.
All right, well, let's start with the components because I really want to start with the components of Core Worlds.
All right, well, what do you have to say?
My cards are warping.
Already?
Yeah, the card stock is... What do you mean already?
Well, we played it.
We all sat around and looked at the fact that my cards were warping.
No, I know.
We've super thin.
We've only played it a few times.
That's the problem.
Well, yeah, after a few plays, my cards started to warp, and that's very, very disappointing to me.
Yeah, well, it's for record... It is a million degrees in here.
It is. It's very moist.
We were melting while we played this game.
We'll break it down.
Except they warped early.
They warped pretty early.
You know, it was like the second round when you noticed that.
So in this game, you get a ton of cards.
Lots of cards.
Everybody gets a player board. There's a couple chits to help you with figuring out your points and keeping track of your energy.
Yeah.
But it's mostly cards. Yep. And that card stock is very, very thin. And I'm going to have to go out and buy sleeves.
Yeah. And we are not fans of sleeves.
That disappoints me.
Yeah. That is an unfortunate thing. Now, on the other side, the art on these cards, I think, is really good.
I think it was okay. Some of the planets, when I was looking at them, though, in the worlds, it was kind of like I was looking at a textbook.
Uh-huh.
Like, is this a real picture of this planet?
No.
Zeus? Because that's a real planet, right?
No.
You mean Neptune, Pluto, Zeus?
Right. It's like way out. It used to be a planet, but it's not one anymore.
What I want to ask is, how is it that the people in this foreign universe have the same mythology as us? That's wild. Talk about parallel. You know, Zeus
and
Cassiopeia.
Yeah. Hey man, we didn't name those core worlds.
No.
First of all, let's talk about the theme a little bit. I like the theme.
Oh yeah,
you are barbarian factions with barbarian ships and grunts and infantry or whatever, and you're going to take over these outlying worlds. That's fun.
Yeah, and there are these great heroes.
Yeah, I wish that the infantry and the fleets would have been more specific to the factions.
Oh,
so like your infantry would look a little different.
That's so
between
nice.
Each faction.
Yeah.
Because they were all standard.
Idea. Yeah, that is
well,
an interesting idea.
You know, you probably cut the price on the card stock.
Yeah, by duplicating
and artwork.
Reusing the artwork.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I got to say, I do like it. I would like to know a little more backstory of some of these heroes, you know. I would love to see the narrative thread sort of played out a little bit more.
You want a small novel?
Yeah, I might. You know, maybe a little appendix with some flavor. A little flavor.
I love fluff.
So there wasn't any of that inside the box, like the rule book?
No.
Just a bunch of narrative stuff. I mean, there is a rich sort of mythology apparently around the Core Worlds universe, and it's an IP that they're going to be developing more. When I spoke to Steven recently with the iOS version, and as they get the new expansion, there's another expansion coming out for Core Worlds. There's already one expansion, but there's another one that's coming out. So we'll see more of this, but I would like to learn more about some of these heroes. They seem kind of interesting to me. And I did like the fact that each of us started with different hero cards that were sort of gave us a sense of the flavor of our people.
Yeah.
So I thought that was neat. I mean, other than that, the cans are all the same.
Yeah, it's all the same except for the hero.
But I like that.
Do you guys think the heroes, because we've played it a couple times, and I've played a couple different factions with different heroes.
Christina is the first on the box top.
I am!
And the second and the third. You have been on the box top a lot on this game. Has anyone else made it on the box top other than Christina?
No.
Patrick, I really wish you'd stop talking.
Yeah,
but
Christina is the master
is
of this game.
I wonder if the heroes are even. Like, their powers, are they evenly the same?
I thought different things, but... Yeah, I think so. I think they're balanced. I mean...
Yeah, balanced.
Yeah, I think they're balanced. I mean, like one of the initial heroes has the ability of... you put some energy on it, and you can use it to bring in some infantry.
Yeah,
you got another one that gives a bonus power to your fleets. You know, the flavor is different. Like, they certainly, it kind of plays up the nature of each of the tribes, if you will. Like, some are infantry based, and some are fighter based.
And I guess I made the mistake, and I've made the mistake a few times, but I had the fighter powered so hero, and I let my game be dictated this last time by that, so I really focused upon fighters.
Yeah,
that
it sounds like we're moving into gameplay.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go ahead and do that. This is a deck building game, as Patrick said during the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a different type of deck building game.
Yeah.
It's not like Dominion or any of those other games where you're buying a card, you're putting it in there. You have a war zone. So I enjoy that aspect of the game as you're trying to figure out, you're trying to balance, okay, do I want to deploy something now? Am I going to be able to take it next turn when it comes back around to me? Or is Christina going to steal it from me?
Yes.
Or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and also another thing I like about this game is that you pull out different decks. There are, what, five decks?
Yes.
Six decks that come out over time, and they get more powerful stuff.
Yeah.
It's more expensive. And there's that nice sort of building your engine, you know, getting everything going, getting your synergies going so that you can get that later stuff so that you're able to get those more powerful plans. I did like that a lot about the design of this game.
Yeah, and I would say that's the one thing about the game that I didn't like.
Oh, really?
I had a hard time, like, wanting to stick with it, knowing that the last three phases are where the payout is.
Mm-hmm.
Of like the first couple of phases, you're kind of like, I have to work so hard to build up enough energy or work so hard to leave out people in my war zone so that the next phase I can actually do something. And it just, the build up to me was kind of like monotonous. And I'm going to say this and people aren't going to like it, but it kind of felt like Smash Up to me a little bit.
Yeah, I don't like it.
But wow. Like, on how hard you work to get
you mean
a point.
Smash Up, the game that you gave a zero rating to?
Right.
Oh, wow.
But, like, it just felt like you worked so hard, and then, like, you plan out all these things in your war zone to get a planet, and then the person who goes before you gets that planet.
But
you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, here's what I'll say as far as one thing that is not as bad as Smash Up. When you can see what everybody's playing out there.
That's true.
And you see what's up there.
Yeah.
So you can know so-and-so's going for this.
Right.
Or so-and-so's going for that. So I need to plan on taking something else because they're going to precede me and they're going to get it before I do. So if you pay attention to that, you can do that.
Yeah, Patrick's right. You can see what the person is massing in their war zone. So that is much different than Smash Up.
Right.
Yeah, and I did that a little more in this game of like paying attention to how other people were going to play or what their next play was going to be. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't, you're going to get screwed.
Yeah,
basically.
You will, big time. Yeah. Well, one of the things I also like about this is that, you know, during a particular turn, you need to make a decision sometimes. This is a time I'm amassing units. So you're going to spend your energy in those early phases. Rather than going for planets, you're going to be going for units. Or you're going to be spending, you know, or you're going to be amassing units in your deployed unit so that you're getting ready for that next round, hoping that a planet you're looking, you've got your eye on, is going to make it to the next round, and you can attack it at the beginning of that round. Like, I do like the fact that you can make those decisions during a particular turn. This is my focus this turn, and this is what I'm going to attend to, and I'm going to give up. I'm going to let somebody else go get planets, hoping that I can get those juicy units during the drafting portion of it.
When I think, I mean, this is the first time that I played it. And so for the first like three or four rounds, I thought I was supposed to kind of get rid of all my war zone.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until like midway that I was like, I could just keep going.
Yeah.
Because I would spend my war zone and attack something. And then the next round I was like left with nothing.
Yeah, no.
Over.
An important tactical component.
So I would do that again. I would collect them.
Yeah.
Since you mentioned this was your first time that you had played it, how did you feel that the rules, when, you know, I was explaining the rules to you, how did you feel that went down? Did you feel like there was too many rules, or was it, this is definitely a learning game, or?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. This was the first time that you guys explained rules where you were doubling up on each other.
Meaning Patrick and I?
Yeah, and so I would look at you and then look at Patrick, and then really, like, about 5 minutes into it, I kind of just zoned off. I looked at Christina.
I felt like Patrick was being my translator.
That's like what I kind of felt like that sketch with the Obamas. And I was like, all right, he's saying it one way.
And
Patrick,
I'm the angry
must
Obama.
Think that I'm a different kind of learner. But I understand the way Rob was saying it.
Okay, well, honestly, that was what I was thinking. I was like, there were a couple of times that Rob would give a rule, and I was like, that's a little more information that you need. Let me just break it down to the basics.
Yeah, so then I was getting all the... Yeah. So I think really, like, if you're playing with me, and it's you two who like to control rules so much, one person decides how to do it, and you both explain rules very well. So
just
I think
don't do it together.
Just don't do it at the same time.
If you had to pick between one of us to explain rules better, who would that be?
I'd have to go with my husband.
Oh,
only.
Stupid
guy. I live with him.
Okay, let's wait, bring it back to core world.
I do want to say something about like the rules in the first time you play this game is the rules are so cumbersome.
They really are.
Like, it's so much. It's like, okay, here's what you, but you have to do this first, but wait, you have to do your energy phase and, oh, hold on, you can only do one action. But I will say that once you play it,
yes,
it's not hard to get.
Right.
This is not a gateway game.
No.
It's not a second level game.
No, this is a complex game.
But the thing is once you get the rules and you see how they interlock with one another,
You get it.
Right. But then
explain it to a new person, you're just like, whoa.
Well, the other thing about it is that about this game, there are a lot of moving parts.
Yes.
There is a lot going on because you've got to think about a lot of things. For example, you've got to be remembering what's in your discard? What's in your draw pile? What have I been drafting? Do I need to balance out by going with infantry? Do I need to balance out by going for more fleet? Do I need to get tactic cards that are going to power up my infantry? Do I have enough infantry to make this tactic card make sense for me? You know, am I likely to get two infantries into play at any one time so that I can use this type formation card to take advantage of it? There are a lot of things that you've got to think about when you're drawing your cards based upon what you've got and what you are getting. And I will say this, after playing it several times, becoming familiar with the card set is important to the strategy of this game.
The more you play, the better you'll get.
I agree.
But let's go back to Carrie with getting all those rules. Was it overwhelming for this particular game?
Yeah, leaving aside Rob and I.
I think it was a little bit long, but it was pretty easy. I think you could maybe make it a little easier. But for me, I like to kind of get a general overview and then start playing and learn. And normally by the second round, I can get it. And I might have to be reminded, like you did, like that goes in your discard pile.
Right.
Because I kept wanting to hold it into my hand.
Right.
Like.
Okay, well, let's move to the interaction in the game.
Okay.
There's not a lot here. There's a couple cards that affect your opponent, but most of your interaction is
solo.
What do I want out of the stuff that I can draft, and can the person in front of me get it before I can?
Yeah, but
that's really it.
That's a lot of interaction
in
this game.
With what the other person
is
doing.
In this game,
it is and it
not
isn't.
Playing off of each other.
Yeah, but in the same way, you have to pay very close attention to what people are getting, where they're moving. For example, you need to pay attention to the cards that people are getting based upon the bonuses that are going to come out. The final, as I mentioned in the rules, the final set of planets will give bonuses. Big scores, and then they're also going to get bonuses based upon what's in your empire.
And all those cards come out.
Yeah, and they all will come out, so you're going to see them all. So you've got to pay attention to, she's getting a lot of cruisers. She's getting a lot of the big ships. She's going to go for Anu, the planet that plays bonuses for that. I need to be ready when that card comes out to beat her to that punch. Or, there's a lot of sort of paying attention to what people are drafting, what they're likely to draft. If you know somebody's weak in infantry and they're going to go for that infantry, you may need to think about drafting something different that turn.
Well, and I think, too, I mean, depending on who's the first player of that round, you have no control over it.
Right.
Because the new cards come out, and if it's a card that's going to benefit that player, like, you just have no control. They're going to buy it, and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah. What do you guys think about the offsets? Because when you play with, three or four players, you're going to have to get some energy because the third and fourth player are not going to see first player as many times as the other. Do you think that's sufficient for this game?
No.
I don't think it is. I never used all my excess energy that I got as an offset to start. Now, maybe I'm playing incorrectly. Maybe I'm not maximizing what I need to do. But, in this last time we played with the four of us, exactly four infantry or tactic cards came out. Or three, or it was four. But by the time it got to me, I went last, so I got two energy. Everybody bought all the good cards. There was one tactic card left that I didn't really want. So I just deployed, and I was the first one, I think, to get a world, but it really didn't do anything for me.
Yeah, and Rob and I have played two players where neither the first player or the second player get any bonus energy, and it didn't really affect anything.
Yeah,
And to piggyback on what Christina just said, I think I enjoyed the two-player more because it went quicker. Now, obviously, if you're playing 2 to 4 players, 4 players are going to go longer. But it just felt like 2 players was like, boom. Okay, now you know Christina can go. With a 4-player, it's more likely that you're going to lose a card that you're trying to get or draft or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, how long did it take to play one game when you played two?
I don't know, an hour maybe?
Maybe. That's maybe a little less than that.
Because this one took us almost 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
we didn't have very many interruptions tonight.
No, we didn't have a lot of interruptions, but we did have some slow play.
Yeah, and that's the thing with this game is there's a lot of text on the cards.
There
you
is.
Have to do a lot of reading. And the really, I think, the way to go about winning is really comboing your tactics
with
your cards and your war zone. And sometimes it takes a minute to figure that out.
Yeah, you were really good at that.
Yeah,
let's talk about the replayability. Now, again, tonight we're just reviewing the base game.
Right
now there's one expansion out and there's another one to come. What do you guys think about the replayability of the game?
I mean, I think there's some replayability. I don't think that it's like extensive without expansions. Like, I'm going to want to see new planets and worlds and new heroes.
Right.
After maybe like more than 10 plays.
Yeah. Well, probably the Galactic more. Orders, we haven't played yet. It does interact differently with the cards. You'll notice that there were some icons on the cards.
Right.
Those icons get triggered in the Galactic Order expansion.
Okay.
So it does change the mechanics and dynamics of the game. But I think that actually the replayability of this is pretty good. And here's why I say that. You're going to see different draws. You're going to see different tactics employed by different people. And as you become more familiar with the cards, when it's not about seeing new cards, it's about seeing new card combinations. It's about seeing new card opportunities. And when you know those cards well, and you don't have to spend time reviewing the text, and you can think about how they're going to interact with the cards you have, and you're going to have different cards in your hand. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of combinations. And when you think about how they're going to interact with the cards in your hand, I think you can create a greater replayability because of that.
So, it's kind of like Dominion. Those cards don't change. They're, you know, unless you get all the expansions and things.
I really want to jump in here.
But just wait your turn.
Okay, I know.
But it's the combos of the cards that make it really replayable.
Yeah.
So I can see where you're coming from. I just don't think it's that high.
Yeah, I agree with Christina. I feel like it is average to slightly below average.
Really?
Because, you know, in that first deck, you have, you know, 2 copies of a lot of cards. You're not getting that, you know, much different combination of cards. Unlike Dominion, when you play it, where you have 20 cards in the base deck, and you don't know what that combination of 10 or 8 starting cards are going to be.
Right, 20 different decks.
Well, yeah, whatever. There's going to be a lot of different cards that you can buy to make combinations. This, you're not going to get that much.
Yeah, but
in the base game.
No, and I get that. What were you saying, hon?
Well, I was thinking that I don't think it's that replayable either. Hmm. Like, it just doesn't seem like it's that fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you're just going to get your fleet or your infantry, and then you're going to collect your conqueror, and then it's just basically who's going to get the most, like which ones you're going to get. Like, I would go for higher conquerors.
Yeah. I just think there are more combinations than you guys are giving it credit for.
I don't know. I still disagree with you, but, you know, I like this game as a 2-player, so I don't mind sitting down with you and playing this game, you know.
Many times. Yeah.
Let's talk, you guys can practice, so you can beat me.
Yeah, you guys played a 2-player, didn't you?
Patrick and I did not, but Christina and I did.
Yeah. We played a 3-player.
We played a 3-player.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the value. You can buy this game right now at Miniature Market for $32.
Miniatures.
Well, it's just the name of the company.
I'm just kidding.
They sell board games.
I'm just kidding.
There's a little fallback from episode 23.
Yeah.
All right. You can get this for $32. What do you guys feel about that?
I think it's kind of high.
For cards that warp, I think it's pretty high.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to agree.
I agree. I'd like to see it a little bit cheaper.
Yeah.
Or better like cards. $25.
Well, I don't.
Make some better cardstock.
Yeah.
I mean, now I have to go out and buy sleeves.
Yeah.
And that really, really disappoints me that they started to warp.
Yeah. Or maybe make everybody aggressively wash their hands.
No, at this point,
and
it doesn't
hand
matter.
And use hand sanitizer.
I think you'd
have to use alum or something to keep your, something to keep your hands dry.
Moisture free. 32, I do think. Is a little high. I'd like to see it a little cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, because you get some player boards, you get a lot of cards, but the fact that those cards are warping really
is an issue for you.
Didn't you say the box wasn't the right size for some of the cards? It was the right size?
Yeah, we were putting them in wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. But the cards reminded me of the cards from, like, trains. Like, they were that thin. They were hard to pick up off the table.
They were a lot... The trains cards were a lot thicker. It definitely had that vellum. That was another thing. They were hard to get underneath. I kept having to, like, get somebody with more fingernails than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, to get them off the table.
Cat nails.
Yeah, I will say, you know, I think you're probably right. That value's a little on the high side. But... I don't know. I mean, it's not too far out of the range.
No, not too far. Not too far.
How much are the expansions?
They're in the 20s. I mean, we just got the Galactic Orders expansion, and I think it was in the high 20s.
Well, why don't we go ahead and rate this game? Our pink peg, blue peg rating system is 0 to 6. 0 means we hate the game. You should probably leave it alone. 6 means you love the game. You want to instantly buy it and give it away as presents. All right, Christina, why don't you start? 0 to 6 pegs. What do you rate Core Worlds?
Well, despite my comment about it being like smash up to me personally, I'm going to give it a 3 pegs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a good rating. I did enjoy it. For some reason, it's weird. It's like I emotionally didn't enjoy playing the game.
You emotionally did not enjoy it.
Right. But logistically, I did because I won.
Yeah,
like,
you
I play
win a
it
lot.
Well.
Yeah.
I play this game well.
You really do. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how because I didn't enjoy playing. It's weird.
Wait, maybe we all just played poorly. You did not enjoy playing it.
I did enjoy playing it because I enjoy playing with you all, but for like the game, like I wasn't like, ooh, what hero am I going to do? Or I just was playing.
You need more from it.
Yeah, I need something else. And which is crazy because like I love Voluspa, so it's like
The connection is that Stronghold puts out both of these games.
Right. Their games are nothing alike.
No. Okay. But I'm just saying, I mean, Bonacore, I still like you.
Yeah.
So three pegs.
All right, 3 pegs. And Christina still likes Bonacore. All right, Patrick, what do you rate this game?
I'm going to give it 4. I have to say, when I first started playing this game, I was blown away. I was like, this is awesome. I love the mechanic of this game. I love the way it plays. I was over the moon. I was like, this may be my new favorite deck builder. And then I got it a few more plays, and it lost its luster quite a bit. It became, I saw some of the tedium associated with playing it. I saw the challenge. But the reason it keeps a 4 rating for me is because I do think it has wonderful complexity. This is a heavy game. And this is a game that I am really looking forward to cracking that nut. I am looking forward to coming up with different ways of winning this game, of figuring out how to make it work, and I am really looking forward to getting this to table with a few of our gamer buddies because I think they will enjoy playing it as well. I gotta say, I am looking forward to future plays of this game, and I'm really looking forward to the expansion. So I think this game is a very well crafted game. But I am troubled by the fiddliness of it. The combos are very hard to keep track of. The actions versus energy can be a bit tedious to track. And it can make for some mathy long, you know, AP. People trying to math out exactly what the plays are. That can make it a little boring.
Right.
But that said, I still think it's a solid game. I'm going to stay with a 4.
All right.
Okay. Carrie.
I'm going to give it 2 pegs.
2 pegs.
Which I think might be my lowest rating.
No.
I couldn't think of which one went lower.
Come on.
But I'll tell you that mine was, I just sat there, and even though I was, you know, engaged with the actions and the energy and stuff, I found it to be pretty slow and boring.
Yeah.
And 2.5 hours, we've done a lot of learning games where I might be the only one just learning it, and they're never this slow.
Right.
You know, and maybe it's just that there's not much player interaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just basically me looking at my cards, trying to figure out what my combos would be, and then the turn was over.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say 2 pegs.
All right, 2 pegs. I'm don't know. I know that I'm supposed to give it a rating right now, but there's so many pros and there's so many cons I'm hurting. Let me just say this. As soon as I played the game three or four times, I immediately purchased the expansion. Mm-hmm. Haven't gotten it yet, but I like the game enough that I want to see what else it offers.
Are there any games that you don't like enough to see what they have to offer? Oh, yes. Wait, I can think of one. Yes. I can think of one.
There's several.
Yeah.
But that says something.
But something that I liked it enough that I see there's enough potential in there that it could be a really fun game. For me, a lot of things come down to replayability. Mm-hmm. I do not feel like this game has a lot of replayability base game. However, there's an expansion out there. There's another one on the way. I feel like that, you know, that's going to add to the, you know, the replayability. But we're just reviewing the base game. The warping cards, I cannot get around.
Yeah,
I cannot get around. I it's hard for me to believe that during play testing that those cards didn't start warping.
Rob likes his cards hard and stiff.
I don't know what my wife just said. I'm pretty sure I should be insulted. But I'm gonna give it a 3.
Okay.
I'm going to give it an average rating. I did enjoy it. I feel like there's going to be replayability. I'm giving it a 3 based on potential. Because right now, right out of the box, I might give it a 2 like Carrie. Right. But I feel like there's a lot of potential in this game. And there's the whole iOS play. Mm-hmm. That is coming out. That is coming for this game in the future. Playing Ascension on just with cards right in front of you, I don't like it. But playing it as an iOS game, I adore it. I think that Core Worlds is going to fall into that category in regards to iOS.
Yeah.
So,
I think it'll be fun. It's going to do all the fiddly math for you. It's going to do all that stuff for you.
So basically what I'm hearing is you're going to be spending more time in the bathroom.
I'm going to be eating a lot of more Fiber One bars.
Great. Yeah.
Is what you're hearing. Great. So let's break it down. Christina gave it a 3. Patrick gave it a 4.
Pegs,
thank you. Carrie gave it 2 pegs, and I gave it 3 pegs.
Yeah. So, you know.
It's about a 3. It's an average.
It's an average rating. I want, not one that we would encourage you to run out and purchase right away.
I think if the price came down a little bit, it's a definite purchase.
Yeah. I'll say this too. You know, keep your eyes peeled or your ears peeled for some other updates from us in regards to this game. We will let you know. We'll get the expansions to table.
Most definitely. Yeah. Once I get those expansions to the table,
we'll let you know.
I want to address it because I want to see if there is actually potential.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, excellent. Well, those are our thoughts on Core Worlds. Now let's move on to our next review, Brussels, 1893.
You're listening to Blue Peg, Pink Peg, a proud member of the Dice Tower Network.
Brussels 1893 is an action selection game designed by Etienne Espremen and published by Z-Man Games in 2014. In Brussels 1893, players take on the role of one of 5 real-world leaders of the Art Nouveau movement, which was born out of a design boom that occurred in Brussels, Belgium, around the turn of the 20th century. Each player works to establish prominence in the field by creating and selling art, influencing patrons, and building their masterpieces. Now, the Pink Peg Carry description of this game is pretty simple. In this 2-5 player game that takes 90 minutes or to 2 hours to play, players use workers to take actions in order to create art, sell art, influence patrons, gain resources, and build upon their individual player board. Each action gives points, and in-game points can be exponentially increased through building up on certain tracks on both the shared board and the individual board. The player that best uses their actions to meet most of the game's objectives scores the most points and wins the game. However, this description just scratches the surface of this involved and wonderful game. For those that want to hear more about this game's play, though admittedly my summary will leave out some game features, can stick around. However, if you want to skip ahead to the review, you can do so. It won't hurt my feelings very much. To skip to the review section where I and the rest of the pegs give our thoughts on this game, you can skip to the 88-minute mark of the podcast now. All right, thanks for sticking around. Just so you know, you guys are my favorites. As I said, I'm going to describe Brussels in greater detail, but I want to let you know, I will leave out or gloss over a few of the game's finer points, because this game is a doozy. The play area consists of two common boards and individual player boards. The common boards are divided between the modular Art Nouveau board and the Civic board. The individual boards break down the game's actions, track progress around the architect track, track in-game bonuses, and contain six tiles that cover up each player's masterpiece. Now, all of the masterpieces are real Art Nouveau buildings of various different styles, and each building is designed by the real artist that each player takes on as their playing role, which I think is a pretty neat detail. Now, I'll get into a detailed description of the components as I go through a description of the game's primary actions. Now, at the beginning of the game, a card from the market deck is drawn. Now, this card has two pieces of information upon it. First, the number of Belgian francs that can be claimed by any player who takes the market action. Second, the coordinates from which the player, meaning the first player, may choose when limiting the available actions on the Art Nouveau board. You see, the Art Nouveau board is a modular board laid out in a 5x5 grid, with each grid space signifying different actions that can be taken. A bracket token is laid along one of two coordinates, and as I said, the first player of the round gets to choose which coordinates to use, that intersects somewhere within that grid. So only the spaces framed along an X and Y axis emanating from that bracket may be triggered during that round. And the number of players determines the size of the grid. Now, once the Art Nouveau player area is established, players, starting with the first player, can take one of their five available assistants and place them, or it, upon a space on the board, either on the Art Nouveau board or on the Civic board. But let's talk about the various actions, starting with the actions on the Art Nouveau board. Now, one action is the create art action, and this is fairly simple. By putting an assistant on this space, the player is allowed to draw one tile from a stack of colored art tiles. And these tiles come in four different colors, and they take that tile and they put that in front of them. That is within the art that they have created. Now, there is a special condition where a player is able to draw a black tile as a secondary action if they control a particular space, but as a general rule, they're going to be drawing from the colored tiles. Additionally, a player who gets a certain tile can draw additional tiles and choose which of those to keep, so they have a choice to choose from when they're drawing from the Art Nouveau deck in order to determine what color they're going to work with. But essentially, that is the make art action. Now, another action that is affiliated with that is the sell art action. Now, when taking this action, a player can take one of their previously obtained art tiles and sell it. Now, first, they adjust the value of the pieces by adjusting a tile in what's referred to as the workshop space. What they can do is they can move a tile with one of the four colors of the art tiles, one on each of its colors, around that board. So one corner on this 3x3 tile is blue, one is pink, one is green, and one is yellow, the colors of the art tiles. And you can move the tile, which starts at the center of the 7x7 gridded workshop board, one space up, down, right, or left for each piece of art that is in front of that player before the sell. So if they had three pieces, they can move it three spaces. This allows the player to raise or lower the price of art pieces, as well as the number of points that are gained for selling that piece of art. Then the player takes the art and places it in one of two spaces above the workshop tile. This shows the color of the art pieces that cannot be sold during later turns, i.e. by the next players. However, these pieces will be covered up by other sold art throughout the game, so this will rotate. The type of art that can't be sold will rotate as the game goes on. The player then takes francs equal to the art's value and gains victory points equal to that art's points value. Now, another action is the theater action. Now, when taking this action, players can recruit a patron from an available stock of four patron cards that are laid out at the bottom of the Civic board. The rightmost of those patrons is free to recruit, with the next costing 1 franc, and the next costing 2 francs, and the final one costing 3. Now, patrons give special powers and abilities, such as the granting of victory points, or extra workers, or movement up certain scoring tracks. Now, these patrons can be used one of two ways. And that will have their ability triggered in one of two ways. One is they can trigger the ability immediately and discard that patron. They get to use it once and they get rid of the patron. Or they can trigger that ability and add that patron in a tap fashion to the player pool of permanent patrons, one of each type may be retained within their individual player pool. Now, these patrons can be tapped one time each round, and their ability can be used over and over again. However, these patrons stay with the player until the end of the game, and they must be paid their varying values in the form of francs at the end of the game, or they will cost the player 5 points per unpaid patron. And we'll talk about a little bit more about how to tap patrons in a bit. Now, the next action is the materials action. A player who takes this action can take two materials from the pool of three basic material types. These materials are what are used to build upon each worker's masterpiece. Now, the final action on the Art Nouveau board is the construction action. Now, when taking this action, the player pays two, three, or four material units to build a sixth of their masterpiece. Now, the first two construction phases cost two material units, the next two cost three, and the last two cost four. However, the materials compass tells which materials must be used to complete this step. See, a compass with two hands pointing to six tiles determines the construction costs, which are one wood, or brown tiles, or rather cubes, one stone, or blue cubes, one iron, or black cubes, one of the player's choice, or three francs. Now, one of the spaces is empty. If one of the hands points to this space, then all of the units must be paid in the value from the type that the other hand is pointing to. Otherwise, it must be paid in both unit types to which the hands are pointing. So, if the hands were to point to wood and stone, a player building a portion of the masterpiece that takes three building units would have to pay one wood, one stone, and one stone or one wood. And that is how they would complete that. Now, once a masterpiece portion is constructed, the player gets 5 points if they didn't use a wild resource, and we'll talk about wild resources in a minute. They also move one of the hands on the compass forward one unit tile. However, they can't be in the same space, so they may not have much choice in that. And they place the tile that covered the portion of the masterpiece that they just constructed on any action space on the Art Nouveau board that doesn't have an assistant on it at that time, either within or outside of the current active player area. That player will get a secondary effect or benefit every time that somebody plays upon that space for the remainder of the game. For example, they may get victory points, or they may get extra materials, or they may get a special black art piece that they can sell using different conditions later in the game. Now, those are the basic actions on the Art Nouveau board. However, I've not talked about the bid action affiliated with the placement of workers or assistants on this board. Whenever a player places an assistant on this board, they must place at least one franc beneath the placed assistant. However, they can place more. And why would they do that, you may ask? You see, at the bottom of each column of actions on the Art Nouveau board, there is a bonus card. And the player with the highest bid value in each column gets to claim that bonus card at the end of the round. These cards provide the means of determining the first player during the next round, but more importantly, these cards can also be triggered for their bonus action, i.e. victory points or movement up the board tracks or gaining a worker, etc., or they can be placed beneath the player's individual board to add multipliers to four end-game bonuses which give points for various things. For example, one gives points for each $4 that they have. One gives a point for each artwork held. One gives a point for each patron retained. And one gives a point for each worker over three controlled by that player at the end of the game. And I can tell you, these bonuses can really rack up, because instead of getting 1 point for each art piece, you can get eight or six or etc. So this multiplier effect can be profound. Now, players could also play assistants on the civic board. Now, the actions on the civic board include gaining 3 wild white material cubes, or 3 cubes that can be used in place of any other material. However, if completing a section with one of these wild cubes, they won't gain 5 points for the completion of that section. Gaining francs equal to the value noted on the marketplace card in effect during that turn. Taking any action on the Art Nouveau board, even if it's in a space that's already occupied by an assistant, or triggering patrons equal to how far up on the Royal Palace track the player has advanced. Now, unlike spaces on the Art Nouveau board, more than one worker can be played on these spaces. That said, the second person triggering the space, if playing with fewer than 4 players, must place 2 assistants and then 3. Also, the player that has placed the most assistants on the civic track at the end of the round will lose 1 assistant to the courthouse. Now, as I noted, each player starts the game with 5 active assistants. However, they each have 2 other assistants that start the game in the courthouse. So, each player can lose workers to or gain workers from the courthouse as play goes on. Now, any player can choose to pass at any time. If they're the first to pass during a round, they take an exhibition marker that will give them help claiming the first player market for the next round, as well as allowing them to draw additional art pieces from which to choose when making art. Meaning, they can draw 2 pieces or 3 pieces, depending on how many they have, and keep the one that they want. The first player also gets a bonus franc, as well as a franc for each color of artwork within their stores. Each other player only gets francs for each color of artwork within their stores when they decide to pass for that round. Now, after all players have passed, bidding for bonus cards is resolved. Then the first player for the next round is determined. Now, on many of the bonus cards and on the exhibition markers drawn by the first player to pass are Manquin Pis icons. By the way, the Manquin Pis is a sculpture of a peeing boy that is emblematic of Brussels' rebellious spirit. The player with the most Manquin Pis icons during that turn takes the first player market for the next round. Next, tapped patrons are untapped, and bonus cards are either triggered or placed beneath individual player boards for their bonuses. Then emblem bonuses are awarded. See, on the Art Nouveau board, there are emblems on the corners of each of the action spaces. Now, for every emblem surrounded on all 4 sides by assistants, points are awarded to the player that has a majority of assistants around that emblem, with points awarded to all players involved in the case of a tie. And the values of the points awarded will differ based upon how high up something known as the City Hall track the player has advanced. And this can be moved up by playing patrons, by playing certain bonuses, etc. Now, the player with the most assistants on the civic board then loses a worker to the courthouse, and assistants are recalled from their other spaces, and bids are paid back into the bank. The bonus cards are refreshed, and play recommences by drawing a new marketplace card and establishing a new active Art Nouveau board. Now, after 5 rounds, patrons are paid, points are deducted if a patron cannot be paid, bonus points are awarded, 1 point is awarded for each material retained, but no points are awarded for the wilds. And the player that ends with a Manquin Pis is awarded 5 points. However, another point source is the masterpiece construction. If a player completed the top 2 portions in their masterpiece, they are awarded 5 points per segment completed, multiplied by how far up the architect track that player has advanced. So a player who has completed all of their masterpiece and advanced to the top of the architecture track by playing bonus cards or triggering patrons that allow for advancement is able to score 100 points, which is a huge point bonus in this game. So completing the masterpiece and advancing up the architect track is truly an important component of this game. So that is the basic rules of Brussels 1893. I know it sounds like a lot, and it is, but once you've started playing, you get a handle of the rules, and they become fairly simple to understand. Plus, the player board and the action spaces provide clues to the actions that are available and the manner in which they are completed. And this can be very helpful. While this game is complex, it's entirely worth the effort. So let's head back to the other pegs and hear what they thought of Brussels, 1893.
All right, Patrick, thanks again for the rules breakdown, this time for Brussels, 1893.
There's a lot in there.
Do you have to say 1893 when you're talking about the game, or can you just say Brussels?
We'll truncate it to Brussels from here on out. But 18, it is Brussels, 1893.
I mean,
yeah, Rob will just say 1893 every time.
Well, let's break it down. What do we think about this game?
Well, can I start by saying something about this game?
Just, no. All right. What do you guys think?
No, I really like this game.
One of the things I love about this game is the theme. I love the fact that it's themed in an Art Nouveau setting. And there is another podcast out there called The Spiel. And they recently reviewed a game called Rococo. And they made reference to the fact that they had a professor by the name of Joe Flauto that used to be obsessed with the Rococo period. Well, I had the very same professor, Joe Flauto. Incredible fact, Stephen Conway and I of the podcasting community both went to college together and both were in the same arts and styles class with Joe Flauto, and he taught us all about the Art Nouveau movement. And I think it is so cool that this game focuses and is such an incredible encapsulation of that movement. The fact that it emerged in Brussels, the fact that the players in this game, you play the primary players.
Patrick,
that
I feel like most of the words that you're saying right now are interesting. Most of them.
No, but the point is, this game...
But that's actually a really good coincidence.
Yeah, no, it is pretty cool.
It's a strong coincidence.
Our university produces a lot of board game... We are. Produces a lot of board game podcasters. It may be leading the world. But in any event, the point of the whole thing is that the art style and the dedication to actual factual details. Every impresario, the patrons in this game, are real patrons from that period. The markers symbolize the most significant exhibitions that took place in Brussels that drove this movement forward. The art is indicative. The pieces that are shown are specific
art pieces.
It's a really
good art history
class. It is an incredible art history
class. I was going to say, do you think that this theme and stuff has really kind of like found the niche for people who have that other interest? Like, do you think if you're not a gamer but you're a big art person that you would want to play this game?
Well, I think it would bring you in the door. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty heavy game.
Like, as far as background themes go, I'd rather play an art game, even if it's the components or the dynamics or the mechanics are the same. Mm-hmm. I'd rather play a game that has to do with art than has to do with Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
I am on the opposite end of the spectrum.
I think most
people like, hey,
are.
Rob, come over and let's play a game about art museum or art collecting or art. Is there a dungeon? Is this a tapestry in a castle?
No, but I mean, if you're the architect who's building your building,
what kind of traps am I putting in to catch those halflings?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well,
is that
I love
why you built your building so tall this time?
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, the drier the theme, the more I love it. I love classic European themes, and I think it is spectacular.
All right, let's break it down.
Sorry, guys.
Let's talk about the components. This game has a ton of components. You've got cards, you've got money, you've got meeples, you've got resource tokens, you've got player boards, you've got a modular board that you got to put together. You've got all kinds of pieces, and everything is great stock.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, that's very
nothing
true.
Warps.
Yeah, yeah. No, the look of this game is incredible.
I like the art style. I mean, if we're going to go back to the art, as soon as you put the board out, I was like, it's like, I know it wasn't this, but it reminded me of like a 1970s art kind of, I don't know.
Say that. However, the 1970s was a revival of the Art Nouveau movement.
Oh
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah. A lot of the looks that we have in the 1970s were kitsch kind of revivals of that look. I mean,
Patrick, we already did our geek out episode, okay?
I do love art.
Come on.
Well, what do you guys think of the look? I mean, I don't want to talk a lot. What do you think?
I mean, I liked it. I thought it was interesting. There's a lot to look at. I mean, so that can be overwhelming with so many icons and things to pay attention to. But I thought it was really interesting in the way they did it. It wasn't
well on the
poorly.
On the bottom of the player boards. There's small icons A, B, C1, C2. Now I read the rules and I knew the rules and I have taught it to you guys. You guys have known the rules each of the times we played.
Yeah.
But even in the last play, there were times when we were, you know, people were saying, "Wait!" I was like, "Wait, we got to do this." You know, there are a lot of rules. Did you feel like those little icons at the bottom? Once you got your arms around the rules, basically, did you think they helped you at all with turn order and remembering those things?
I don't think so. I mean,
forgot to even look at them. There was so much to look at on that board and so many things going on and getting blocked out that I didn't even look at the crypt sheet.
Yeah, I think it helped when you were laying your building tiles on the board.
Right.
I mean, that because, you know, where do I want to lay it based on what bonus I want to get off of it?
That was
helpful.
Yeah.
It was helpful to me. Once I understood what all the iconography was, it was very helpful to me. But at first couple rounds, I'm like looking at it going, I don't know what I'm looking at. It looks like hieroglyphics.
Right. Well, I think my take on this is I think the graphic design on this, you know, meaning the layout and all that stuff, the iconography, I think it was exceptional. I think it was very clear. I think it was very simplistic. You know, they used small icons to symbolize big things. I was in awe of it. I spent a lot of time kind of looking at it going, man, this is a lot of work went into it.
Yeah, I'll say the design of just the board game and how the game goes together was very thought out. There is no wasted space on this at all.
Yeah.
It's very intimidating as a player sitting down because you look at the board. Again, you have a modular board. You've got two sections for two different types of cards. You have something called the compass. You've got a market square. You've got two different tracks, one of them for how many points you're going to get, another one that gives you, I can't remember what the other one is, for how many times you could tap cards. You've got another place where you can put additional workers to do other things. You know, and then you have a scorecard all around that. It's just, it's intimidating to look at.
Yeah, it is. It is intimidating to look at.
It's intimidating, but once you know the rules and you've played it out, the board makes sense.
Yeah, the board definitely makes sense.
It really does.
And where things lay.
The columns and the rows.
Are clustered well. You know, one of the things I would say is on the Civic track, there's the Art Nouveau track and there's the Civic track. It was a little small, those spaces, the various of the four spaces were kind of small. The ones where you went to get four wilds and the ones where you went to take any action and that sort of thing. They were a little small given the fact that later in the game, they're going to start getting loaded up with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, workers or assistants. I think those could have been a little bit bigger, but then I don't know where that would have gone on the board.
Right.
That would have been my only small gripe. Otherwise, I think the components in this game are stellar.
Why don't we move over to gameplay? There is a lot going on.
Oh, man. The first time Patrick taught us the rules of this game, I was in my head, I was going, what is going on? Oh, my gosh. Because it is intense.
Yeah. Now, I had to read the rule book, one of the best written rule books I've ever seen in a game. Really well done. But I read it, had to read it again, and then I had to sit down with it and play out two rounds with three players, you know, dummy players, so that I, with the book next to me, so I could make sure that I had all these rules figured out. Because there's a lot going on in this game.
There's a lot of rules and there's a lot of mechanics and how those play with each other. It takes about two or three turns to kind of get the game, but two or three games to actually get everything,
right.
I feel.
I agree with that. I mean, we've played it, you know, a few times, but not a lot. And I still don't know. I feel like I need to play it more to really get a sense of what game strategies I can employ in order to win this game.
Well, this was the first time that anybody completed a board, like their buildings.
Mm.
And Rob did that and got ahead of us by 100 points.
Yeah.
Like, I never realized how important that part was.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you have to pay attention to a lot of stuff going on. And I think it can be overwhelming with all the multiple actions that you can take. But I really did like the mechanics of what this game introduced, like the compass. That was really cool.
Yeah, great mechanic.
And then the bracket piece that lined out the Art Nouveau board, that was really interesting. So you kind of had control over the board game that you were playing on.
I think that's my favorite part of it, is putting the bracket down.
Yeah.
Like, or watching like what we're going to play and like hoping that you're not going to get blocked out or that you're going to be able to get some secondary.
Yeah, and you're talking about the workshop space I discussed in the rules overview. And it is a really neat element. And the way that the they're laid out so that, you know, if something's on one end, you can really hurt somebody else through your movement because you're going to bring their prices down. It's a neat element in this game.
One of the things in reference to, a Euro game, you know, with the Feld games, when you play those, you want to pay attention to all aspects of how you get points because you want to spread yourself out. With this particular game, to me, it feels like you need to pick one thing that you want to do, whether it's get a bunch of the noble guys, what are those guys called?
Patrons.
Or if you wanted to focus on art, selling it and buying it, or if you wanted to build your building. Like, for example, as Carrie just mentioned, this last time we played, I went straight building. Everything was working the track that gave me the bonus for the building, playing the building, getting the workers. That's what I did, and I didn't do anything else. I think I need to play this game more to figure out if that is indeed correct. If you need to focus on one thing or if spreading it out. Like, if, for example, you guys built buildings, but it did nothing for you except for give you bonuses when someone landed on them.
Yeah, which weren't significant. Yeah.
And I think, too, even like finding a track, a route that you want to go and sticking with it, but also being really cognizant of your placement on the Art Nouveau board, like so that you can get the majority of that grid placement. I mean, Patrick, this last time you played, you were racking up like 10, 15 points each time because you had every majority of the grid.
Well, he had gone up on that track, so his points were worth
more. On the civic track.
Yeah, so it's not only am I going to do art collection, but it's also like where am I playing on the board because there's so many ways to get points.
So many ways.
Let's move over to interaction. There's a ton of interaction here. Yeah. Whether it be blocking someone out of a position, that first player picking the bracket with what places are going to be able to be able played on this time, or moving the compass, or moving the market. You know, you are constantly, almost all the actions you do, you're affecting someone else.
Yeah.
And I would say that lent to a lot more than usual of analysis paralysis is because there's like, so many actions that you're really pondering every possibility to figure out what's the least restrictive for yourself.
Well, I will say this about this game. This was one of the more contentious games that we've played in a while.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that there's a lot of thinking, so you're waiting for other people, and that wait can create a lot of like real tension, not game tension, but like human tension. And I've experienced this a couple of times with this game and a few others. In action selection games where it will take somebody a long time, you are hoping and praying that they don't take the action that you're waiting for.
Right.
And when they take a long time to make their move, it's uncomfortable. I mean, it's so, and you know what happened with me? 80% of the time during this game, when somebody would take a long time and I was feeling that sort of feeling, they would waste all my time and all my anxiety and then end up going exactly where I didn't want them to.
And then you get this, you SOB.
I restrained myself a bit.
Sort of.
Yeah, a bit, I said, during this game. Well, Rob very often precedes me in gameplay, and I've discovered. And so I feel comfortable saying, gah. And I don't know why I let him precede me in gameplay, because he knows.
Yeah, you guys should switch it up.
No, we should switch it up. Because you took a lot of, but you did too, Christine. A couple of times you cut me out of a couple of things.
I know. I have filed those choice words you used against me in my head. Don't worry.
But you guys played it. I got to say, this was a tight game. At the end, this last game we played, at the end, Rob won by a healthy margin.
Yeah.
But
when I thought I was actually in second for a while, and then when I found out about those building points and how much Rob was actually going to collect.
Yeah, when you actually
I was out of the game.
Yeah, that 100 points is big. And as far as interaction, I want to, you know, just say what I got to figure out is there a way you can win the game without building everything? You know?
Yeah.
That's the one thing I haven't been able to figure out. I mean, if somebody builds everything, that is.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. If one person builds, then they're the winner, unless two people build.
Right.
But when we played before, no one built, so it was a lot more, you know, we were closer in realm.
Well, that plays into, the play interaction a little bit, because you are going to have to pay attention to what other people are doing in the game to
Absolutely.
Know whether or not you've got to pursue that tag. Because when I saw Rob was going to be able to get his building completed, we should have hate blocked on him. We should have. The only way any of us were going to have a chance at that point, that late in the game, to be able to not have him beat us was to take those 50 points away from him.
See, and
we had to, we didn't do it.
Yeah, and I guess, I don't know. I think with me, when I see that happening, it's like, okay, how do I figure out how I can win the most points rather than spending my energy on how to blocking you?
I agree. And I did the same thing. And I was trying to spend my energy to get those double point doubles.
Right.
And you ended up bidding me out of that.
Right.
And I wouldn't have won anyways, but it would have given me, what, 10 more, 20 more points?
Right.
And so I was trying to focus on that. And I agree with you. That was a tactic that I made. But I think, you know, we might have been able to
lessen the spread.
Exactly.
I think this would be one of the only games that I would play like as a let's get one person.
Right.
Because I typically don't like those kind of games or being part of that. But if I know that they're going to kill us because they're going to get the end of the building, then I would be totally fine with gaining up on somebody.
Right.
It was all about the timing of when you could do that.
I agree with that.
I mean, you could have let me spend all my time doing it in the last round. Everyone's like, by the way, we need to stop him from doing this.
Yeah.
And I would have adjusted my play accordingly.
Right. And I think you probably could have done so effectively. You had a couple of options, it looked like to me. But the thing I would say is that I don't know that it's possible to win this game without getting at least one of your top building components built.
At least one of them.
I don't think you have to get them both, but I think you may have to get one, because when you're giving up all, you know, you're spending four plus, I mean, you're spending tons of action to build up those four for nothing.
It took me the entire game to do it.
Yeah,
you guys were speeding away from me. I had like 19 points. You guys had like 50-some points. I was looking like I was going to lose.
No, and I didn't think you were. I saw where you were going, and I was like, there's 100 points in that. And I was – so that's why I started – you know, I was like, I'm just going to focus on art. I'm going to get as much as I can, and I'm going to try to make 100 points in art. You know, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
But you can do that only by tucking those cards and saving them. And that's something that, you know, you have to decide every time you get a card or a patron, is if you're going to keep it or, like, keep it for later or just get the points.
Right. And I had 9 tucked. I mean, I had a big multiplier going. It just wasn't big enough.
Let's move on to replayability. Okay. There is a lot of replayability to this game, because, you know, one side of the board, the modular board, is for, it has a newbie side, and then you flip it over and there's a harder side.
Right. And you can mix that
up.
So you can go intermediate. Right.
Yeah.
And you get a different selection of patrons, a different selection of, what is the other cards on the other track? Bonus cards. There's, you know, in the market track, that always changes.
Right.
So there's a lot of things here, but I think mostly it depends on who you're playing.
Because
everybody's going to have a different strategy when they play this game, and they're going to try something. So that's where, try something different, maybe they'll try something that's the same, but that's really where the replayability lies, is in your opponent versus the game, though there is a lot to the game.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, the ability to make the Art Nouveau board, the grid board, look different based on where you lay the pieces, that could have a lot of replayability, because that would affect your when you lay the bracket of what options you have to choose from. I also think that the workshop, you know, depending on what art pieces you play, kind of kicking out the other colored art pieces, that, you know, that has a lot of, there's just a lot of variability. And I think the only thing with playing with multiple people or different people is that if you are playing someone who knows how to win the game or has found that niche on how to win, they're always going to play that way. So that's not going to make it as exciting. Yeah.
That is one of my concerns about this game. There's a couple of, like, for example, Puerto Rico, great game. Really wonderfully designed, but there's a tactic you can use that gives you, that's like a tactic towards victory. Yeah, but I mean, the point being of that, there's certainly a stronger tactic. There are certain things that if you don't do them, you won't win the game, and if you do them, you're going to maximize your potential. And my concern with replayability here is that very question of, I want to get more plays in to determine, are there multiple paths to victory in this game? Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you can win this game without, you know, maxing out your building and maxing out your drafting, you know, your artist multiplier? I think there is, but I think it requires you engaging more with the interaction of this game and paying attention to what other people are doing and limiting their ability to get 100 points. I think if somebody's able to get 100 points,
like playing more
win.
Defensively.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Or make it cost more for them.
Right.
Because if you block me out, I'm going to have to use the, was it the civil? What is it?
Right.
Yeah.
The civic track, right. Which means you're going to lose workers. Which means it's going to be harder for you to go for it. Right. I think that's exactly right.
That you have to be willing to forfeit some workers. Right. If you're going to block you out.
Right. But if we're going to block him out, we have to take some actions that may not be as efficient.
Yeah, because then you would have to use more.
Right.
Yeah.
You get him off the Art Nouveau board so that he has to go to the civic track in order to take advantage of that. And I think that's right. I think this game is a high-level game.
Yeah.
And my only kind of reservation in sort of ruling on replayability is I need to play it more.
Right, yeah, right.
I'd play it again with the four of us immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it would play... We haven't played with five players. Like, what does that game look like? Oh, my gosh. The resources are going to be gone quickly. You don't have anywhere to play. It would just be a madhouse.
Well, the board will be bigger with five because on the track you'll make a larger action selection area, so there's going to be more options available. But it's still going to be tighter.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Well, you answered my question. I was going to see how it scales for lower than four players, like two players. But it does scale with the cards that influence the market.
Yeah, and we've only played it with four.
Right.
So we can't really speak to how it plays with two, how it plays with three. And typically we've given this a number of plays that we would typically feel very comfortable giving it a review. But we have to kind of give a caveat on this one. This game has got so much complexity to it that. You know, we want to reserve sort of the question of replayability because we haven't determined whether or not there's a maximum, you know, there's an optimal position for playing this game.
Like, I'm excited to play it again.
Oh, I am too.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to play it again. My only misgiving is that there do seem like they're presenting to us some options for victory in this game that I want to make sure that they can be mitigated against.
Are there any expansions out right now for Brussels?
No. This game is brand new.
Oh, I knew that. But what I was thinking was if there aren't any expansions, that could lend to the higher ability of replayability.
Yeah.
Maybe there's more patrons that do stronger things.
Yeah. I think that could be nice. I candidly think this game's going to take long for me to crack. If they're going to put an expansion out, I'll wait because I gotta get this one figured out.
I don't feel like there would be an expansion for this one. I think this one speaks for itself, and it would be too hard to add anything else in it.
Just because,
yeah,
so
and I'm
complex.
Not saying it needs one.
Right.
I was just saying if there was one, it could be.
Right.
Why don't we talk about the value of the game? You can get this right now, Miniature Market, for $44. Thoughts? Yeah.
I think that's a high price, but I think it's a value. I think this game is worth that money. I think it is. The components are wonderful.
Yeah.
The look is wonderful. The play is so unique. It just is like nothing else that I've played in a very long time. So I think it's a good value.
Yeah, and you get a lot of play out of just playing it once. I mean, it's an in-depth game. It's intense. There's a lot going on. So you can walk away from it going, all right, I don't need to play another game tonight. I'm good. Like, your brain's
spent. I would play it again.
No, I mean, you could play this game, but, like, I wouldn't encourage playing this game in addition to other games in one night. Like, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it'll burn.
But I'm also not one of you guys.
Yeah, that's true.
I concur with you, good sir. I was trying to be...
A patron?
A patron.
Yeah, I got it.
Right.
Yeah.
I had some mutton chops and maybe a monocle. Nothing?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you think the value is good then? So
yes,
yeah,
I do.
Okay. What about you, hon? I mean, this is a little above your price
way
point.
Up over my normal scale, but for this kind of game and this complexity and this much replayability for me, I think it's worth it.
The theme brings a lot of value to
you,
doesn't
it? Yeah, and I like the theme.
I just
enjoy it more than some of the other ones based on that.
You can get behind your character.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, let's give our final impressions, our blue peg, pink peg rating, 0 pegs to 6 pegs. You know the drill. Christina, what are you going to give this one?
I'm going to give this game, I'm going to give Brussels a 4 pegs. I really liked this game. It was really in depth and, you know, playing it for the first time when you do it, it's going to feel overwhelming. And so that's just a warning. It is, I don't know what tier you guys would think it is, but I think it's a higher tiered game.
Brain burner, yeah. Top tier.
Yeah, brain burner. So that kind of made my eyes cross a little bit at times. But I liked how it played. I like having multiple options on how to play. I would just say maybe like go slow when you're learning this game and then play it more and more and more to get familiar with it. But so four pegs for me, because I think over time this could be a game that you love to play.
Yeah. What about you, Rob?
I really want to give the game a 5. I'm not giving it a split one. The game is fabulous. It scratches my itch, my Euro itch. I love how all the mechanics play with each other. I love the interaction. I love the cards. I'm talking myself up into the 5. I love the modular board. I love everything about this game. However, the one thing that bothers me is the fact that if it is lopsided on the building, where you can go and you build the building, everybody else is doing everything else that they're doing, and maybe they're focusing on art, or maybe they're focusing on something else, and you do the building and you complete it, you've automatically won. I don't know if that's an issue or not, but it seems like it could be if it just needs more plays. Yeah. So I'm going to give it a solid high 4. Right. And I might come back one day and say, I'm going to change it to a 5 when no one cares. But yeah. I'm going to say right now it's a high 4, almost a 5.
Okay, excellent.
And I'm going to be Rob's parrot. Exactly, just put it in my voice.
Mm-hmm.
But my big thing with this is I was almost to a 5, but it's the building part. And if that's if you can win every time by doing that, or someone else can, then it takes the fun out of the game.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say a solid 4.
Now, it might not be.
It might not be that way, but actually, that's why I want to play it again today.
Well, let me answer that.
I'm going to...
So you say 4, and the same reasons that Rob has.
Yeah, so I want to go and play it again, mm-hmm. where I'm going to only do the building part.
Right.
And see if that happens.
Yeah, here's my take on that. We have, in the plays that we've given this, we have been playing as reviewers. And while we've been playing to win, we have been really focusing upon understanding the mechanics and, kind of understanding the components. We've been talking a lot of back and forth in the game as we played about the features that we like and whatnot. And I honestly believe that that is not an issue. And here's why I don't think that's an issue. Because there's so much interaction in the game that you can, a canny player, a sophisticated player, and we are all sophisticated player, but we've been kind of approaching this from a different point of view. A sophisticated player is going to see those trends developing. I saw you moving up on the track, and my thinking was, let it go, build up in your direction, and you can mitigate that. He will come up 100 points, you'll get 110, and everything will be fine.
Here's my problem with that.
Yeah.
Here's my problem with that. Let's say I've spent my entire time building that building. We're at round 4, okay? And now you're going to start moving in on me to stop me from doing it, all right?
Yeah.
So let's say you successfully stop me. I get nothing.
Right.
I get 0 points.
Right.
So it's no longer interesting for that person.
Well, I think, though, that at that point in time, everybody, you have to see those things developing earlier, and you have to see them developing. And if you see somebody coming in on you, you need to think, can I deal with this assault? Can I break through this? I think that is a extraordinary challenge. I'll tell you what, I would love to play a game where I know it's break or make or break, and I've got some people that are challenging me, and I've got a tactic where I'm going to take that make or break, and I'm going to play it out. And if I get 0 points and I lose the game and I come in last place because I wasn't able to make it happen, I'm okay with that because I took up that challenge and I tried to apply my tactics to that. But if I break through that, I feel great, you know? I think that makes for an engaging play. I think that – and the other thing is that everybody's going to be – you've got to play. You've got to balance that. You've got to spend some energy on making that building work. But you've got to be more efficient about it than you have been, Rob. You've got to figure out a way to do it so you can do a few other things on the side so that when everybody's going in that direction, then you're able to do that. And the other thing is
I really don't know how I could have been any more efficient. I didn't do anything
well,
else.
Well, because you were all but unchallenged. You know, you were all but unchallenged. I think there were some things. I think you could have sold a little bit more.
So you're saying, like, as if we had blocked him out, then he would have had nothing.
Right. Well, all I'm saying is that I think this game, if someone goes uncontested for that, which is essentially what you did, none of us contested you in a major way, then that they're going
to
win.
I'm sticking to my 4.
All right, that's fine.
You almost had me uptick to 5, but I'm going to stick with the 4.
Well, I'm going to give it a 5.
Okay.
Based upon that, because I've already seen, thinking through some ways that I think I might be able to mitigate against that in the future, this game is going to get a lot of play by me. I am going to be bringing this to a lot of different people for them to see it. I I had a blast teaching this game. It is so
wonderful.
You had
more fun teaching this game.
Yeah,
you look
yeah.
like a little magician over there.
Yeah.
Like, well, why? You're asking me why this patron does this? I'll tell you.
Well, I got to be honest with you. Carrie, I have taken some feedback that I got from Carrie, and I planned out my rule instructions when I started teaching you guys this. I wanted it to be perfect. And so I felt like I, you know, kind of hit my sweet spot with that. But anyways, the other thing is I like the way this game lays out. The book laid it out in such a great way, I just had to follow that guideline. But anyways, I'm going to give this 5 pegs.
It's a good one.
Mm-hmm. So in review, we've got four pegs from Christina. Strong four pegs from Ron.
Almost a 5. Almost, Brussels. Almost.
Yeah.
4 pegs.
4 pegs from Carrie and 5 pegs from me for Brussels, 1893. We think it's a winner. It's a heavy one, but we think it's worth your time. Okay, well, listen, everybody. We appreciate you guys hanging out with us for a couple of reviews. Hopefully, we gave you some stuff to chew on and some games to think about. And as always, everybody, have some fun.
Play some games.
Woo! Artwork makes me happy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Blue Peg, Pink Peg. If you like what you hear, why not head over to iTunes or to www.boardgamelinks.com and give us a good rating or give us a heart. It helps other people discover who we are and what we do. Of course, you can always go to our webpage at www.bluepegpinkpeg.com. There you can find our show notes, where we give greater details about all the stuff we discuss during our episode and give information about the pegs and what they're doing. You can always find us at Facebook, Twitter, Stitcher, and BoardGameGeek, all by searching out Blue Peg Pink Peg. Why don't you go over to BoardGameGeek and join our guild? There you can join the conversation with us and other members of the Peghead Nation. Blue Peg Pink Peg is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Blue Peg Pink Peg is a production of In Your Ear Media, all rights reserved. Blue Peg Pink Peg's theme music is written and performed by Skavooby and the Epitome.